Another dispute with Trump. A lawsuit by his social media company against Brazilian Supreme Federal Court Justice Alexander de Moraes, who has suspended various social media accounts, at one time including Elon Musk's X, and censored a conservative commentator for hate speech. Justice de Moraes, a well-known critic of the Brazilian far right, will sit in judgment of Bolsonaro. Leave it to Trump to defend hate speech abroad. The language issue popped up in the White House again the other day when the heads of four African nations gathered there. They listened to Trump praise Liberia's president for his English. "Such good English," said Trump to President Joseph Boakai. "Where did you learn to speak so beautifully? Where were you educated? Where? In Liberia?" Trump just couldn't let go. English has, in fact, been the official language of Liberia ever since the country's founding by escaped and freed slaves in 1822. And here's Trump, obviously knowing nothing about the country, embarrassing himself and his guest with that compliment. A Liberian opposition politician said Trump's comments were condescending and showed disrespect for Africans. Boakai's office was kinder, saying Trump's appreciation of the president's English was a good thing. But President Boakai was obviously forced to bite his tongue in view of Liberia's dependence on the U.S. Trump's dissolution of USAID is badly hurting Liberia, which relies heavily on U.S. public aid, health aid. The U.S. tariff increases add to Liberia's burden. The common lesson of the Brazil and Liberia exchanges is that they have harmed U.S. relations, not only with those countries, but probably also with Latin America and Africa generally. Diplomacy based on threats and conducted with disrespect are bound to lead those on the receiving end to look for alternatives. You can be sure that China will be the chief beneficiary. Beijing is already Brazil's and Africa's primary trade partner. Trump has left the field open to further Chinese influence. I'm Mel Gertow for the Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Josh Salem and Mel Gertoff. The producer is Hannah Francis, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Dr. Anthony Lysowitz, Suzanne Potter, Mandy Stapleford, Zamone Perez, and Rick Steve. The interim evening news director is Hannah Francis. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Leuschner. All our KBOO programs are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to the number 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth.
Our in-depth guest today is Mary Desch, author, under the pen name M.M. Desch, of the new novel Tangled Darkness. The book is a psychological thriller featuring a woman psychiatrist, which just so happens to be Mary's longtime profession. The character Leslie Schoen finds herself in the middle of an investigation into missing prescription opioids, as well as a murder, and she's the prime suspect in both cases. Tangled Darkness is Mary's first novel and was shortlisted for the 2023 Chanticleer Clue Book Awards. In the words of writer Susie Vitello, Desch deftly weaves a tale of deceit and reckoning. This psychological labyrinth is a gripping page-turner. Well, Mary, first, congratulations on Tangled Darkness, your debut novel, which releases tomorrow, July 15th. It must be very gratifying to see it in print.
Oh my gosh, I can't tell you. It feels fantastic.
Now, it's been a long journey to the novel's publication, and it starts with what I read, your love of crime and detective fiction, going back to reading Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine as a kid. My parents loved that. We got that, plus Ellery Queen, and my mom never missed an episode of Perry Mason, so I know the feeling. You wrote a blog post on the topic, A Debut Author's Perspective on the Thriller Genre's Enduring Appeal. What's the appeal for you?
You know, it's that question, what is happening here? And I just love the puzzle quality of that.
Oh, yeah, figuring it out.
Yeah, and I tend to go for the character-driven, character-rich thrillers when I'm reading. And so it's always a study in personality, psychology of the characters. And that's, of course, right up my alley.
Now, from your love of crime fiction, and this is where the right up your alley comes in, you took a bit of a detour working as a psychiatrist, specializing in addiction for over 3 decades. Why this path, though I think psychiatry involves a certain amount of detective work?
Well, it really does. Do you know, medical doctors were very important to my family as I was growing up. I was one of 7 kids, and 3 of the kids had cystic fibrosis, which is a very difficult condition. Many children don't survive. And so the family doctor's visit to the house was crucial. And so I felt like I wanted a crucial job. And by age 12, I determined I was going to go to medical school. But once I got there, you know, I was speculating, do I really want to be in primary care? And then I got on this psychiatry rotation at the Veterans Hospital in Omaha. And I tell you, I was just enthralled. I was, what's the word? I was just fascinated by how the differences in people showed up and why. And so that just led me right into psychiatry.
Wow, that was quick. So that pretty much sparked your entire career, just that very first experience with psychiatry.
Yeah, it was amazing. There was more to it. I felt very home or at home amongst the people that worked in mental health, behavioral health care. I came from a family with mental health conditions, and you know, where several members had mental health conditions, and that was also fascinating to me. You know, what was the underpinnings of why one person might land in a severe depression, but another person in similar circumstances didn't? And so I just really wanted to understand. And I think part of it was I wanted to help my family members. I wanted to learn as much as I could so I could be helpful.
While practicing psychiatry during those 3 decades, were you also writing on the side, fiction or nonfiction?
I wasn't writing fiction. I was writing in my journal. And probably by my early 30s, I discovered the power of journaling. Like, for example, setting out at the beginning of the day what's on your mind or what you have in mind to achieve or to pursue, and then following how now the language is setting your intention tended to unfold. Journaling just grew into a habit of mine, sometimes more, sometimes less. But I did not write creative fiction until I retired from practicing medicine. I wrote all kinds of medical reports. I can't even count, but those didn't count.
No, they're not fictional, hopefully.
Right.
Now, of course, all that great experience and knowledge of what you call on your blog, the complexities of the human psyche, led you to writing the new book. When did you start on the manuscript, and what was your initial idea for what became Tangled Darkness?
You know, I finally decided I'm hanging up medicine. It was December 2019. Interesting timing, right before COVID. And I had bought this book. I bought 2 books. They were used books, one for me, one for my wife, Liz. And I showed her the book that I got for her. And she went, I don't think I really want to go for that. Isn't that like 10 years old? And the title of the book was Soul Contracts, something like Realizing Your Divine Potential or something like that, by Carolyn Mace, who's a fantastic author.
I know her. I've read some of her work. Yes.
Yeah. She's such a spiritual guru. And so I started leafing through it and I thought, I'm going to read this. This is perfect for me because I'm in this transition. And what appealed to me too was there was a huge journaling project associated with the book, all these questions. So as I was journaling out and discovering my personal archetypes, all of a sudden characters started to appear in my journaling. And I just got this idea I could write. Now, this was as the COVID lock, it was right before the lockdown. And then when the lockdown happened, just a few days later, I talked with Liz about my idea of writing a murder mystery. And I wanted to set it in a mental health clinic. I wanted it to be a small group practice. I wanted to build on the foundation of what I had been through in life. I had invited her to be part of the project, and she, you know, respectfully declined, but supported me in my idea. And that's how it got started.
I love you, but you're on your own. No, I found the writing very polished, especially for a debut novel. And the story was a real page turner. I mean, every blurb I've read says the same thing, and I have to agree. How'd you ramp up on writing a longer work of fiction, going from journal writing to fiction writing, and what resources did you have here in Portland?
You know, that was such a learning project, and still is. I was so fortunate to run into many people who were helpful. For example, Angela M. Sanders is a author who's written a couple of murder mystery series. And I'm trying to remember how I got hooked up with her, but I met with her and she told me about Sisters in Crime. And I later joined in a critique group with her. It was kind of a bunch of non-coincidences of how I began to get help. And I had also had this longtime friend, Diane Greenwood, who's now working on publishing, I think, her fourth novel.
Yeah, I've interviewed her for two of the books.
Yeah, and she's fantastic. I just love her. She's been writing for 30 years. She's just such a good friend, and she was very encouraging. She read my beginning pages, the first 60 pages, the first draft, and it was incredible. The feedback she gave me just encouraged me to keep going. Lots of resources. I could go on.
Well, you mentioned a few in the acknowledgments, and some I've interviewed. Laura Stanfill, Diane, you mentioned Nancy Townsley, Susie Vitello, Michael Keefe. So I know there's a real sense of community here, and you got involved with that. The lead character is Leslie Schoen. She's a psychiatrist with a focus on, quote, legally connected mental health cases, which include opioid addiction. And she's a recovering alcoholic, now married to Izzy. You mentioned your wife is named Liz, by the way.
Yeah.
There's little similarity. Who's pregnant with their first child. And there's an element of Leslie, of course, in your own experience.
Oh, there's a lot of my personal experience that laid the foundation for the character of Leslie. You know, the setup in the small mental health group practice, the lesbian psychiatrist who's married, her interest, her side interest in forensic psychiatry or medical legal cases was an interest of mine towards the latter half or in the latter half of my career in psychiatry. So we have many things in common. And then I started to create.
I was also going to mention the setting, which is right here in Portland. And of course, it has to do with opioids and opioid addiction and turns out to be a crime syndicate selling stolen prescription opioids. We definitely have a problem in the city with illegal drugs, a growing problem. One character in the book, she's a medical examiner, tells Leslie that over the last 4 years in Multnomah County, opioid-related fatalities increased by more than 25%. And she adds, that's after a 30% drop in the previous time frame. Mary, you didn't make up those figures for the book. That's reality.
No, I researched it. And unfortunately, it's so sad to see that the opiate addiction problem just continues to surround us all. All you have to do is, you know, go outside, go to your neighborhood downtown area, go to a neighborhood park, and you can spot who is struggling with addiction. And you can also struggle, or you can also spot who's struggling with, let's say, meth versus fentanyl. So it's just a heartbreaking problem. I tell you, back in my days of practicing, when Suboxone first came out, I thought this is going to be great, because then I was doing a lot of hospital consults and opiate addicted patients would get admitted to the medical hospital because of abscess or overdose or whatever. And then they'd call in the psychiatry consult, help this person, you know? And I thought, okay, they're going to be landing in withdrawal really soon here. If I could use Suboxone in the hospital, that would be fantastic. So I got credentialed to use Suboxone. A long story made shorter, not long afterwards, a DEA agent showed up in my outpatient office to say, I'm here to investigate your Suboxone practice. So that whole thread in the book is really based on a personal experience.
Yeah, I was interested in that because, of course, you had the background in addiction counseling, the opioid problem, and then you had this incident with the DEA agent. But the book also has characters from the Portland police, medical examiners, even a Mexican drug syndicate, two very shady characters. How'd you go about doing that research?
Well, with the detectives and police procedure, I had three key areas. One, a good friend who's a retired police commander. We met back in Phoenix. She was actually a neighbor of Liz and mine, and she was one of Liz's personal training clients. And Marty now lives in Ohio and is still a very good friend of ours. So Marty Burkett listened to many of my questions about police procedure and answered a lot of questions. And then this organization, Sisters in Crime, had a week-long intensive workshop on crime scene analysis that was run by a former FBI agent. And so that was extremely helpful.
Wow, what a great background.
Yeah, then finally the forensic part of it, the pathology and the coroner's view and all of that, I have a sister who's a pathologist. So I was calling my sister quite a lot about those events in the book.
It gives the story a lot of credibility. I have one last question, Mary. You previously published a novella, Lethal Loyalty.
Yes.
Which your website describes as setting up book two in the Portland Murders series. That book's titled Play Me Once, Tangled Darkness is book one. Can you tell us about the series and how the stories connect and how many books you plan in the series?
Yeah, so far I have Play Me Once in first draft and ready for edits. I have book three ready in outline form. Yeah, my idea was to try to emulate Tana French as much as I could. Her first four books became the Dublin murder series. And how she did it was she would take a character from book one, let's say, and who was more of a minor character or, you know, not in the forefront, and then make that character the protagonist in book two. So what I'm doing with Tangled Darkness, you'll remember there were several references to Leslie's second cousin, Grace, and the book ends.
That's how the book ends. She calls Grace. Yeah.
The book ends with her calling Grace. So in book two, Grace is the protagonist.
Ah.
Oh, and Leslie and her mother-in-law will be part of the book.
Oh, okay. So we haven't seen the last of Leslie shown.
No, and Leslie has a much larger role in book three, as does Detective Davis. Detective Davis will be the protagonist in book three.
Oh, great, because you kind of fall in love with the characters, or certain of them. certain you're happy to see go in one way or another.
Right. And you definitely want to know, you know, what about the baby that Izzy's about to deliver? So I have to follow up with that as well.
Well, Mary, thanks so much for talking with us about Tangled Darkness. And you'll be launching the book Thursday, July 24th, 7 p.m. at Portland's Annie Bloom's Books. And we'll mention all that information in the close. So again, many thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you for this opportunity.
We've been talking with Mary Desch, author under the pen name M.M. Desch, of the new novel Tangled Darkness. Mary will be launching the book Thursday, July 24th, 7 p.m. at Portland's Annie Bloom's Books, 7834 Southwest Capitol Highway. You can find out more about Mary, her work, and all her upcoming events online at mary-desch.com. This is Ken Jones for KBOO's News.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Welcome to KBOO News In Depth. I'm here with Street Roots Managing Editor Karina Brown to talk about an article by Street Roots reporter Jeremiah Hayden. The article is titled, PPB Protest Settlements Cost the City Over $9 Million Since 2020. With potential for increased protests amid federal threats, Street Roots examines current restrictions on police violence in Portland. Hi, Karina. Thanks for being here with me.
Hey, Hannah. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So $9 million since 2020 is quite a lot. Will you give me a little bit of an overview on the pie pieces that this is divided up into?
Yeah, that amount covers claims back to just a few days after police murdered George Floyd in May of 2020. So it's comprising all claims against PPB since then that have been settled. And it includes both settlements paid to people who made claims and also the city's attorney fees, including both city attorneys who are city employees and also like the outside attorneys that they had to hire to address these claims.
Mm-hmm. So tell me a little bit more about this litigation and settlement costs. Can you give me a few specific examples?
Yeah, according to the city's risk management document, which Jeremiah obtained, there's like a list of different reasons protesters claimed that PPB violated their rights and then settlement amounts associated with different claims. So for example, the highest payout that the city paid was $771,000 to one person. There's very little information on that claim. The document just says it alleges that their civil rights were violated. Another claim alleged, the quote from the city document was that this person alleged injuries after she was hit with flashbang grenades during a protest, and the city paid that person $414,000. Another was alleges she was assaulted by PPB during a protest, costing multiple injuries. The city paid $245,000 for that. And another person said officers injured her when they tried to take her phone, and the city paid more than $297,000.
So there's some interesting information about the less lethal weapons used by Portland police. So can you give me a little bit of an overview of what these are and when police are authorized to use them?
Yeah, we wanted people to just kind of have a clear idea of what to expect out, you know, if they're potentially facing down police. So that's kind of what this sidebar goes into. Tear gas can be one of several different chemical compounds, and police can use that after a commander determines that they should. So a commander has to decide, just like a random officer can't decide on their own. So the commander gives the authorization, and then police have to give two fair warnings to the crowd. Fair warnings in quotes that tear gas will be used. And those have to involve sufficient time for people to disperse. The same goes for state police. Rules in general for federal agents, like the ICE officers guarding the federal building, are much less clear. Federal agents also need authorization from a commander to fire tear gas, but we don't have a lot of details on like how they make those decisions or then what the requirements are, if any, beyond that. Homeland Department of Homeland Security agents in specific must attempt to identify themselves and also issue a verbal warning before using force in general. So that's tear gas. There's also flashbangs, smoke grenades, and what police call kinetic impact projectiles, which can be hard foam projectiles and other things. So for those, Portland police and state police can use them if an individual officer believes that a person's conduct justifies the use of force. So that leaves a lot of room for officer discretion, but they can't target anyone's head unless they believe that the person's conduct justifies use of deadly force. Additionally, Portland police are barred from targeting journalists, legal observers, and other neutral bystanders. And that all applies to state police as well. For federal agents, it's a similar situation to the tear gas rules where a commander authorization is required, but beyond that, we don't have a lot of details. And then finally, flashbangs and smoke grenades, their directives for not only federal agents, but also state and local police are pretty vague and don't outline when flashbangs and smoke grenades can be used at protests.
And then what are some of the health implications of some of these less lethal weapons?
Yeah, tear gas is flammable. It's toxic as well if it's swallowed or inhaled. It can cause allergies and asthma symptoms. It can also cause eye, skin, and respiratory irritation, and that's all according to the manufacturer. The impact rounds I described that don't have irritants, that are just like the foam impact rounds, for example, are also highly flammable. They contain lead salts, which present not only long-term health hazards, but they're also toxic to the environment. Again, that's according to the manufacturer. Pepper balls cause skin irritation and eye damage. And partly because of all of that, Portland police are required to consider proximity to residential areas, hospitals, schools, and freeways or areas with high density traffic. That's according to city administration rules. And just for context, the ICE building is adjacent to multiple residential buildings, to OHSU facilities. It's right next door to an elementary school, and it's right by I-5 with busy on-ramps to multiple freeways right there.
I'm curious if you have anything else that you want to say about this article to sort of wrap it up.
Yeah, I mean, as I mentioned, kind of the article was to lay out what people could expect to maybe, you know, see or not see, or just to be aware of what police are allowed to do under, you know, the federal constitution, the state constitution, state laws, city laws, and also rulings in these lawsuits. And with keeping in mind that, you know, these lawsuits, they result in money for people who filed them, but they also result in additional restrictions on police. That's a big part of the motivation for filing and fighting these lawsuits. So a lot of these rules that were that Jeremiah laid out in the article are the result of this round of protests that we just went through in 2020, and the actions by police that people witnessed and experienced during that time, and then responses by state lawmakers and city leaders and federal judges, including the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. So, you know, I think it's important that people understand just kind of like the lay of the land and what the police can't just do anything. They can take certain actions, and then their actions are restricted by, you know, all of these kind of layers. And also that for people to know when they're out there, but also as like a base level for potential accountability, if, you know, if we're going into kind of a new protest area, which looks like we might be, you know, what people should be watching for in terms of accountability, what journalists could be looking at, what kinds of behaviors, you know, are allowed under all of these rules and which are not.
Great. Thank you so much. And where can folks find this full article?
It'll be online, but I really encourage people to go and find the paper in, you know, full real life paper format and buy it from a vendor. There'll be vendors outside of our offices and lots of regular places as well.
Thank you, Karina. Appreciate you being here with me.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
You've been listening to KBOO.
Radio's greatest application is in broadcasting mass entertainment. Probably one of the best ways to get started is to make it a hobby and build an amateur station. It will show you more quickly than anything else whether or not you can succeed in radio.
KBOO.